Side 3, Old 20th, by Joe Haldeman. Continuing on page 89. The Empire State Building is finished. King Kong will climb it this year. The Chrysler and Woolworth buildings. The architecture is charming, these few decades between skyscrapers and the geometrical blandness of modernism and international style. There was an unmarked door at 269 West 45th. I knocked on it and a peephole opened. I said, "Frankie," and a deep male voice answered, "Johnny," and the door swung open. The place would still be in business in year 10, 2066 old style, though it will have been a legal steakhouse for most of that time. In 1933, until December, it was just one of New York's 32,000 speakeasies. On December 5th, the noble experiment would come to a close, having turned a nation of legal beer and wine drinkers into scofflaw hard liquor boozers. I followed the bouncer up a narrow, winding staircase with the black and white tiles that would still be there in my future, up to the bar, which smelled like new wood under the predominant smell of tobacco, spilled beer, and whiskey. There were a couple of dozen people chatting and drinking at small tables. I ordered a Boilermaker, a beer, and a shot of whiskey, and got a pack of desert horses, camels, from the cigarette girl. There was a radio playing tinny jazz. The combination of not-too-cool beer and cheap bourbon was pretty awful, which I didn't take to be an anomaly. A young woman dropped herself on the other chair at my table, looking around and then at me. "Bum a snipe, sport." I passed her the camels and a small box of matches. She lit up, took a deep drag, and slumped back. "So, Jacob, find anything?" "Diane?" "Bruce, actually." In observer mode, you could look like anybody. "I see what you mean about the olfactory deficit," he said softly. "Anything else?" "Nothing yet. I thought you were doing 1948. "There and back, yeah. I just stayed hooked up and recalibrated." He put his hands under his large breasts and looked down at them. "Wow. I wanted to come tell you before you out-processed. The smell's back in 1948. Diane backed me up on it. But it's sure not here now."
"So what do you think?"
"I don't know. I guess for data's sake, you might want to go lateral." He pulled a set of postcards out of his purse. "Try Philadelphia, Bombay. I'll go with you. Sniff around." I riffled through the cards. "Miami?" "You..." Sudden bright sunshine. "Got it." We were on a crowded beach. Bruce was still a well-endowed woman, clamped in an unrevealing electric blue one-piece swimsuit. We were a generation away from bikinis. I had on long shorts and a T-shirt and a broad-billed hat. I took a deep breath. "Maybe not the best choice. Nothing subtle here. The rotting iodine smell of seaweed with an undertone of fish. Coconut oil on sweating bodies." I steered us away from the sea, up toward the pastel art deco of this part of downtown. "It ain't New York," I said. Bruce stretched so hard his cartilage popped. "Like I'm complaining." The sky was a flat wash of cobalt blue. A biplane buzzed through it. A couple of older women, passing, looked pointedly away. Bruce was underdressed for the street. "They still have biplanes now," I said. "See them over the beach till the end of the century," Bruce said. "They can cruise dead slow, towing a banner." He took a deep breath, impressive chest swelling. "I think it's here." We weren't quite off the beach yet, on the sidewalk, but the smell was there, the city smell, not half as strong as New York, but the same components, sewage, garbage, petroleum products, and their exhaust. "Yeah, I get it too." Bruce was still holding the postcards and flashed one. "Philadelphia?" "Why not?" Suddenly, it was gray and cool. I had on a trim seersucker suit and a straw boater, and Bruce, male again, wore classic dark blue flannel, double-breasted with a tasteless orange tie. We were standing in front of the Liberty Bell. "One breath." "It's here, too." Bruce nodded. A phone rang a few yards away, in a wooden booth.
The door worked smoothly with a pleasant creak. It smelled of pine and shellac. Hello?
Jacob, it's Becca. We have to pull you guys back for a meeting.
All right, give us 10 seconds. I hung up. Close your eyes, Bruce. Rebecca's pulling us back.
What for?
He closed his eyes tightly. Didn't say, some meeting. I squeezed mine shut, too. Otherwise, in observer mode, everything runs together and gets painfully bright. At the end of a normal session, you quietly fall asleep and then wake up outside. Observers either push the button or just get yanked, and if you don't have warning, it can be an unpleasant surprise. 9. Meeting of Minds. I felt the couch moving and opened my eyes, gently pulling out the catheter, then ripping off the electrodes with a couple of jerks. Rebecca handed me a glass of water and had one in the other hand for Bruce. I drank greedily and took a couple of deep breaths. "Seems to be just New York," I said, as Bruce rolled out. "At least not Miami and Philly. We ought to try the World's Fair in Chicago."
"Maybe tomorrow," she said. "We have updated visitors from Earth."
Oh, shit. The telepresence carriers were AI and dumb as posts. It would be better just to live with the time lag a few days, but Earth thought it was cool. It was George. It was the bee's fucking knees. She handed me my greens and looked at the wall clock.
"We've got about 20 minutes. Not really time to go and change."
"I can live with greens if the toys from Earth can. This is about Alex?"
"The death, yes. Of course, Earth doesn't have the autopsy results yet."
"So this is just Sanitas with the telepresence modules?"
"Yeah. They're waiting in the comm room."
She gave Bruce his water and repeated the scant information. When we were both presentable, we went downstairs and walked across the pond to the comm center. We seemed to have a surplus of ducks. I considered fitting a French confit into my Spanish menu next week. The French cook, Maxine Chu, had tried that with the stock duck formula and given it up, so it was a challenge always in the back of my mind. That would be high on the list if the current complications would allow me to do my other job. The protein sequencer could crank out a carload of ersatz duck meat from its data banks. Too old, imprecise data. I'd tasted it, and it was like dry chicken dark meat. To get the real flavor, I'd have to supply them some actual fresh duck to analyze. The comm center stage was a corny holo box. They had it set up to look like a meadow with chairs. How was that better than a plain stage with chairs? The two telepresence modules were sitting there with the quiet patience most inanimate things have, an old-looking man and a young-looking woman. I didn't recognize the woman, but the man was Walter Cronkite from the 1960s, who reported on the American space program then. I'd talked with him, or it, a few times. He was usually the only one. Of course, neither of them was physically there any more than a template character in the time machine is. They were standard holo projections that were sent up weekly from Earth, semi-autonomous, like virtual robots carrying bundles of new data. People on Earth would eventually watch our conversation in a similar setup about a week from now with holo simulacra standing in for us. Probably not in a meadow. There were 3 medical people from Sanitas and their coordinator, Cleo Bannister, sitting in a semicircle facing the modules. Bruce and I nodded hello and took the 2 empty chairs. "I suppose we're all here now," the Cronkite clone said in his radio voice. "Thank you for joining us, Jacob and Bruce." I couldn't suppress a yawn. "Okay, what's the score?" Oops, wrong century. "Why was this meeting convened?" "The score is 0 to nothing, Cronkite said. "We're hoping to improve it."
"The autopsy results will be reviewed by dozens of specialists on Earth," the woman said. "And the virtuality records studied by nearly 100 specialists. Meanwhile, we do have preliminary data that might be of use."
"Nothing quite like this has ever happened on Earth," Cronkite said. "Before immortality, we have records of 8 people who died during virtual reality experiences."
"We have those records, too," I had to say.
"They all seem straightforward enough," he plowed on.
undiagnosed or misdiagnosed pre-existing conditions that should have disqualified the victims from VR. Diseases that contraindicated emotional stress, mostly heart problems.
Except for two, I said. Those two are the interesting ones, the woman said. Emotional stress, deliberate emotional stress, exacerbated by illegal drugs.
That's what they said at the time, I agreed. The people pumped themselves up and put themselves into such extreme situations that they died essentially of shock. That's not really possible anymore. I remembered my recent trauma in the trench in World War I. Automatic asymptotes of physiological response to emotional experience. You could put yourself through a virtual meat grinder and survive to do something even more stupid.
That's not relevant to Alex's experience either, Bruce said. I was there as a template along with Jacob. I looked at the record this morning in flat screen. She was just getting drunk in a speakeasy and listening to the kind of music she loved.
I nodded. She'd been to that time and place before. Maybe that's a factor.
A lot of people have favorite targets, the woman said.
This isn't Earth, I said.
She looked at me, slightly wall-eyed. Please explain.
They were informed, but not bright. Earth's virtual reality network is 1,000 times larger and more complex than ours, and is updated every instant. The longer we travel, the more we diverge from it. So things could be true of our system that are not true of Earth's. We can update discrete things like Bruce's Austrian museum, but they're like snapshots. The ship's communication and computing power couldn't keep track of a tenth of Earth's network, even if it did nothing else.
It could also have to do with our smaller population, one of the doctors said. With the same 800 people using the system over and over, we might be stressing it in ways the Earth system never would be stressed. What happens to a small system if a person does the same thing over and over? He asked me.
It's been done, especially by artists and historians. Of course, people like me and Bruce do it pretty often, seeking out and repairing temporal anomalies. It doesn't seem to harm us.
But you don't do it as patients, clients. You're more or less in control of the illusion.
When we go in like that, as observers, yes. But then we go in as regular users, too, to check the work. If too much time travel, especially to the same period and place, was dangerous, we'd be the first ones to be affected.
After a short silence, the female telepresence said, "We think the two who took drugs were suicides. Could Alex have been?"
"That wasn't in the data we got," the senior medic, Martin, said. "He was the one who had wept at seeing her corpse."
"It's not in the Earth data. Cronkite and I worked it out from the data and what we know of human nature."
Martin stared at her.
"But you aren't human. You aren't even organic."
She stared back. "You don't have to be human to think, or organic to be alive, in a sense."
Technically true, but her saying it gave me a chill.
"There were traces of chemicals in their blood that at the time were used to control depression, before the war," Cronkite said.
"I knew her," the senior medic said, something more than exasperation in his voice.
"She was not depressed. She was not suicidal."
He looked around.
"God knows we've all known suicides."
"Not in a long time," Cronkite said, and he was right. It was the leading cause of death for about 20 years after the war, but those of us who made it through that period seemed reconciled to the fact of continuing existence. Nowadays, death was always accidental, or on Earth, brought on by disease during pregnancy.
Bannister echoed my thoughts.
"I don't know how long it's been since we've had a death that was not accidental."
"That's true," Cronkite said. "You don't know."
"There are no accidents," an actual human said.
Elie Wiesel, I remembered from my encyclopedic childhood. But he was speaking from a theological point of view, not medical.
"Our last death was back at Chimborazo," Bruce said.
"A fuel dump explosion. It was an accident."
"Unless the person who died caused it, on purpose."
"Was he the only one there?"
Cronkite looked objective and wise.
"Of course he was," I said, wishing I could give his logic circuits a good shaking. "If other people had been there, they would have died too.
So we